Chapter 7. I don't know if they took us all that weary way back in the crawler, or if Wormface sent a ship. I woke up being slapped, and was inside, lying down. The skinny one was slapping me, the man the fat one called Tim. I tried to fight back and found that I couldn't. I was in a straitjacket thing that held me as snugly as a wrapped mummy. I let out a yelp. Skinny grabbed my hair, jerked my head up, tried to put a big capsule into my mouth. I tried to bite him. He slapped me harder and offered me the capsule again. His expression didn't change. It stayed mean. I heard, "Take it, boy," and turned my eyes. The fat one was on the other side.
"Better swallow it. You got 5 bad days ahead."
I took it, not because of the advice, but because a hand held my nose and another popped the pill into my mouth when I gasped. Fatty held a cup of water for me to wash it down. I didn't resist that. I needed it. Skinny stuck a hypodermic needle, big enough for a horse, into my shoulder. I told him what I thought of him, using words I hardly ever use. The skinny one could have been deaf. The fat one chuckled. I rolled my eyes at him. "You too," I added weakly.
"Squared."
Fatty clucked reprovingly.
"You ought to be glad we saved your life. Though it wasn't my idea. You strike me as a sorry team. He wanted you alive."
"Shut up. Strap his head."
"Let him break his neck. We better fix our own selves. He won't wait."
But he started to obey. Skinny glanced at his watch.
4 minutes.
The fat one hastily tightened a strap across my forehead. Then both moved very fast, swallowing capsules, giving each other hypos. I watched as best I could. I was back in the ship. The ceiling glowed the same way. The walls looked the same. It was the room the two men used. Their beds were on each side, and I was strapped to a soft couch between them. Each hurriedly got on his bed, began zipping up a tight wrapping like a sleeping bag. Each strapped his head in place before completing the process. I was not interested in them.
"Hey, what did you do with Pee-wee?"
The fat man chuckled.
"Hear that, Tim? That's a good one."
"Shut up."
"You..."
I was about to sum up Fatty's character, but my thoughts got fuzzy and my tongue was thick. Besides, I wanted to ask about the mother thing, too. I did not get out another word. Suddenly, I was incredibly heavy, and the couch was rock hard. For a long, long time, I wasn't awake, or truly asleep. At first, I couldn't feel anything but that terrible weight. Then I heard all over, and wanted to scream. I didn't have the strength for it. Slowly the pain went away, and I stopped feeling anything. I wasn't a body, just me. No attachments. I dreamed a lot, and none of it made sense. I seemed to be stuck in a comic book, the sort PTA meetings pass resolutions against, and the baddies were way ahead, no matter what I did. Once the couch gave a twisting lurch, and suddenly I had a body. One that was dizzy. After a few ages, I realized vaguely that I had gone through a skew-flip turnover. I had known, during lucid moments, that I was going somewhere, very fast, at terribly high acceleration. I decided solemnly that we must be halfway, and tried to figure out how long 2 times eternity was. It kept coming out 85 cents plus sales tax. The cash register rang, no sale, and I would start over. Fats was undoing my head strap. It stuck and skin came away.
"Rise and shine, bub. Time's a-wastin'."
A croak was all I managed. The skinny one was unwrapping me. My legs sagged apart and hurt.
"Get up."
I tried and didn't make it. Skinny grabbed one of my legs and started to knead it. I screamed.
"Here, let me do that. I used to be a trainer."
Fats did know something about it. I gasped when his thumbs dug into my calves and he stopped.
"Too rough?"
I couldn't answer. He went on massaging me and said almost jovially,
5 days at 8 gravities ain't no joyride, but you'll be okay. Got the needle, Tim?"
The skinny one jabbed me in my left thigh. I hardly felt it. Fats pulled me to a sitting position and handed me a cup. I thought it was water. It wasn't, and I choked and sprayed. Fats waited, then gave it to me again.
Drink some this time.
I did.
Okay, up on your feet. Vacation is over.
The floor swayed, and I had to grab him until it stopped.
Where are we?
Fats grinned, as if he knew an enormously funny joke.
Pluto, of course. Lovely place, Pluto. A summer resort.
Shut up. Get him moving.
Shake it up, kid. You don't want to keep him waiting.
Pluto? It couldn't be. Nobody could get that far. Why, they hadn't even attempted Jupiter's moons yet. Pluto was so much farther that... My brain wasn't working. The experience just passed had shaken me so badly that I couldn't accept the fact that the experience itself proved that I was wrong. But Pluto? I wasn't given time to wonder. We got into spacesuits. Although I hadn't known, Oscar was there, and I was so glad to see him that I forgot everything else. He hadn't been racked, just tossed on the floor. I bent down, discovering Charlie horses in every muscle, and checked him. He didn't seem hurt.
Get in it,
Fats ordered.
Quit fiddling.
All right, I answered almost cheerfully. Then I hesitated. Say, I haven't any air.
Take another look.
I looked. Charged oxyhelium bottles were on the backpack.
Although, if we didn't have orders from him, I wouldn't give you a whiff of Limburger. You made us for 2 bottles and a rock hammer. And a line that cost $4.95, er side. Sometime,
he stated without rancor,
I'm gonna take it out of your hide.
Shut up. Get going.
I spread Oscar open, wriggled in, clipped on the blood color reader, and zipped the gaskets. Then I stood up, clamped my helmet, and felt better just to be inside.
Tight?
Tight,
Oscar agreed. We're a long way from home.
But we got air. Chin up, pal.
Which reminded me to check the chin valve. Everything was working. My knife was gone, and so were the hammer and line, but those were incidentals. We were tight. I followed Skinny out with Fats behind me. We passed Wormface in the corridor, or Awormface, but while I shuddered, I had Oscar around me and felt that he couldn't get at me. Another creature joined us in the airlock, and I had to look twice to realize that it was a Wormface in a spacesuit. The material was smooth and did not bulge the way ours did. It looked like a dead tree trunk with bare branches and heavy roots, but the supreme improvement was its helmet, a glassy smooth dome. One-way glass, I suppose. I couldn't see in. Cased that way, a worm face was grotesquely ridiculous rather than terrifying, but I stood no closer than I had to. Pressure was dropping, and I was busy wasting air to keep from swelling up. It reminded me of what I wanted most to know. What had happened to Pee-wee and the mother thing? So I keyed my radio and announced, Radio check! Alpha! Bravo! Coca!
Shut up that nonsense! We want you. We'll tell you.
The outer door opened, and I had my first view of Pluto. I don't know what I expected. Pluto is so far out that they can't get decent photographs, even at Luna Observatory. I had read articles in the Scientific American and seen pictures in life, bone-stelled to look like photographs, and remembered that it was approaching its summer, if summer is the word for warm enough to melt air. I recalled that because they had announced that Pluto was showing an atmosphere as it got closer to the sun. But I had never been much interested in Pluto. Too few facts and too much speculation, too far away and not desirable real estate. By comparison, the moon was a choice residential suburb. Professor Tombaugh, the one the station was named for, was working on a giant electronic telescope to photograph it under a Guggenheim grant, but he had a special interest. He discovered Pluto years before I was born. The first thing I noticed as the door was opening was click, 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 and a fourth click in my helmet as Oscar's heating units all cut in. The sun was in front of me. I didn't realize what it was at first. It looked no bigger than Venus or Jupiter does from Earth, although much brighter. With no disk you could be sure of, it looked like an electric arc. Fats jabbed me in the ribs.
Snap out of your hop.
A drawbridge joined the door to an elevated roadway that led into the side of a mountain about 200 yards away. The road was supported on spidery legs 2 or 3 feet high, up to 10 or 12, depending on the lay of the land. The ground was covered with snow, glaringly white even under that pinpoint sun. Where the stilts were longest, about halfway, the viaduct crossed a brook. What sort of water was that? Methane? What was the snow? Solid ammonia? I didn't have tables to tell me what was solid, what was liquid, and what was gas at whatever hellish cold Pluto enjoyed in the summer. All I knew was that it got so cold in its winter that it didn't have any gas or liquid, just vacuum, like the moon. I was glad to hurry. A wind blew from our left, and was not only freezing that side of me, in spite of Oscar's best efforts, it made the footing hazardous. I decided it would be far safer to do that forced march on the moon again than to fall into that snow. Would a man struggle before he shattered himself and his suit? Or would he die as he hit? Adding to hazard of wind and no guardrail was traffic, spacesuited worm faces. They moved at twice our speed and shared the road the way a dog does a bone. Even Skinny resorted to fancy footwork, and I had 3 narrow squeaks. The way continued into a tunnel. 10 feet inside, a panel snapped out of the way as we got near it. 20 feet beyond was another. It did the same and closed behind us. There were about 2 dozen panels, each behaving like fast-acting gate valves, and the pressure was a little higher after each. I couldn't see what operated them, although it was light in the tunnel from glowing ceilings. Finally, we passed through a heavy-duty airlock, but the pressure was already taken care of, and its doors stood open. It led into a large room. Wormface was inside. The Wormface, I think, because he spoke in English.
Come!
I heard it through my helmet, but I couldn't be sure it was he, as there were others around, and I would have less trouble telling warthogs apart. Wormface hurried away. He was not wearing a spacesuit, and I was relieved when he turned, because I could no longer see his squirming mouth. But it was only a slight improvement, as it brought into sight his rear-view eye. We were hard put to keep up. He led us down a corridor, to the right through another open double set of doors, and finally stopped suddenly, just short of a hole in the floor, about like a sewer manhole.
"Undress it,"
he commanded. Fats and Skinny had their helmets open, so I knew it was safe, in one way. But in every other way, I wanted to stay inside Oscar, as long as Wormface was around. Fats unclamped my helmet.
"Out of that skin, bub. Snap it up."
Skinny loosened my belt, and they quickly had the suit off, even though I hindered. Wormface waited. As soon as I was out of Oscar, he pointed at the hole.
"Down!"
I gulped. That hole looked as deep as a well, and less inviting.
"Down now!"
"Do it, bub. Jump or be pushed. Get down that hole before he gets annoyed."
I tried to run. Wormface was around me and chivying me back before I was well started. I slammed on the brakes and backed up, glanced behind just in time to turn a fall into a clumsy jump. It was a long way to the bottom. Landing did not hurt the way it would have on Earth, but I turned an ankle. That didn't matter. I wasn't going anywhere. The hole in the ceiling was the only exit. My cell was about 20 feet square. It was, I suppose, carved out of solid rock, although there was no way to tell, as the walls and floor and ceiling were the same elephant hide used in the ship. A lighting panel covered half the ceiling, and I could have read if I'd had anything to read. The only other detail was a jet of water that splashed out of a hole in the wall, landed in a depression the size of a washtub, and departed for parts unknown. The place was warm, which was well, as there was nothing resembling bed or bed clothes. I had already concluded that I might be here quite a while, and was wondering about eating and sleeping. I decided I was tired of this nonsense. I had been minding my own business out back of my own house. Everything else was Wormface's fault. I sat down on the floor and thought about slow ways to kill him. I finally gave up that foolishness and wondered about Pee-wee and the mother thing. Were they here? Or were they dead somewhere between the mountains and Tomball Station? Thinking it over glumly, I decided that poor little Pee-wee was best off if she had never wakened from that second coma. I wasn't sure about the mother thing, because I didn't know enough about her, but in Pee-wee's case, I was sure. Well, there was a certain appropriateness to the fix I was in. A knight-errant usually lands in a dungeon at some point, but by rights, the maiden fair ought to be imprisoned in a tower in the same castle. Sorry, Pee-wee. As a knight-errant, I'm a good soda jerk. Or jerk. His strength is as the strength of 10 because his heart is pure. It wasn't funny. I got tired of punishing myself and looked to see what time it was, not that it mattered. But a prisoner is traditionally expected to scratch marks on the wall, tallying the days he's been in, so I thought I might as well start. My watch was on my wrist, but not running, and I couldn't start it. Maybe 8 G's was too much for it, even though it was supposed to be shockproof, waterproof, magnetismproof, and immune to un-American influences. After a while, I lay down and went to sleep. I was awakened by a clatter. It was a ration can hitting the floor, and the fall hadn't helped it, but the key was on it, and I got it open. Corned beef hash, and very good, too. I used the empty can to drink from. The water might be poisoned, but did I have a choice? And then washed the can so that it wouldn't smell. The water was warm. I took a bath. I doubt if many American citizens during the past 20 years have ever needed a bath as much as I did. Then I washed my clothes. My shirt, shorts, and socks were wash-and-wear synthetics. My slacks were denim and took longer to dry. But I didn't mind. I just wished that I had one of the 200 bars of Skyway soap that were home on the floor of my closet. If I had known I was coming to Pluto, I would have brought one. Washing clothes caused me to take inventory. I had a handkerchief, 67 cents in change, a dollar bill so sweat-soaked and worn that it was hard to make out Washington's picture, a mechanical pencil stamped, "Jay's Drive-In, the thickest malts in town," a canard, "I make the thickest," and a grocery list I should have taken care of for Mother, but hadn't because of that silly air conditioner in Charton's drugstore. It wasn't as bedraggled as the dollar bill, because it had been in my shirt pocket. I lined up my assets and looked at them. They did not look like a collection that could be reworked into a miracle weapon with which I would blast my way out, steal a ship, teach myself to pilot it, and return triumphantly to warn the president and save the country. I rearranged them, and they still didn't. I was correct. They weren't. I woke up from a terrible nightmare, remembered where I was, and wished I were back in the nightmare. I lay there feeling sorry for myself, and presently tears started welling out of my eyes while my chin trembled. I had never been badgered not to be a crybaby. Dad says there is nothing wrong with tears, it's just that they are socially not acceptable. He says that in some cultures, weeping is a social grace. But in Horace Mann Grammar School, being a crybaby was no asset. I gave it up years ago. Besides, it's exhausting and gets you nowhere. I shut off the rain and took stock. My action list ran like this. 1. Escape from this cell. 2. Find Oscar, suit up. 3. Go outdoors, steal a ship, head home, if I could figure out how to gun it. 4. Figure out a weapon or stratagem to fight off the worm faces or keep them busy while I sneaked out and grabbed a ship. Nothing to it. Any Superman capable of teleportation and other assorted psionic tricks could do it. Just be sure the plan is foolproof and that your insurance is paid up. 5. Crash priority. Make sure, before bidding farewell to the romantic shores of exotic Pluto and its friendly, colorful natives, that neither Pee-wee nor the mother thing is here. If they are, take them along, because, contrary to some opinions, it is better to be a dead hero than a live louse. Dying is messy and inconvenient, but even a louse dies someday no matter what he will do to stay alive, and he is forever having to explain his choice. The gummed-up spell that I had at the hero business had shown that it was undesirable work, but the alternative was still less attractive. The fact that Pee-wee knew how to gun those ships, or that the mother thing could coach me, did not figure. I can't prove that, but I know. Footnote. After I learned to run one of their ships, Could I do so at 8 gravities? That may simply call for arch supports for a worm face, but I knew what 8 G's did to me. Automatic pilot? If so, would it have directions on it? In English? Don't be silly, Clifford. Subordinate footnote. How long would it take to get home at 1 gravity? The rest of the century? Or just long enough to starve to death? 6. Occupational therapy for the lulls when I went stale on the problems. This was important in order to avoid coming apart at the seams. O. Henry wrote stories in prison. St. Paul turned out his strongest epistles incarcerated in Rome. Hitler wrote Mein Kampf in jail. Next time I would bring a typewriter and paper. This time, I could work out magic squares and invent chess problems. Anything was better than feeling sorry for myself. Lions put up with zoos, and wasn't I smarter than a lion? Some, anyhow. And so, to work. 1. How to get out of this hole? I came up with a straightforward answer. There wasn't any way. The cell was 20 feet on a side, with a ceiling 12 feet high. The walls were as smooth as a baby's cheek, and as impervious as a bill collector. The other features were the hole in the ceiling, which ran about 6 feet still higher, the stream of water and its catch basin, and a glowing area in the ceiling. For tools, I had the stuff previously listed. A few ounces of nothing much, nothing sharp, nor explosive, nor corrosive. My clothes, and an empty tin can. I tested how high I could jump. Even a substitute guard needs springs in his legs. I touched the ceiling. That meant a gravity around 1/2 G. I hadn't been able to guess, as I had spent an endless time under 1/6 gravity, followed by a few eons at 8 G's. My reflexes had been mistreated. But although I could touch the ceiling, I could neither walk on it nor levitate. I could get that high, but there was nothing a mouse could cling to. Well, I could rip my clothes and braid a rope. Was there anything near the hole on which to catch it? All I could recall was smooth floor. But suppose it did catch. What next? Paddle around in my skin until Wormface spotted me and herded me back down, this time with no clothes? I decided to postpone the rope trick until I worked out that next step which would confound Wormface and his tribe. I sighed and looked around. All that was left was that jet of water and the floor basin that caught it. There is a story about 2 frogs trapped in a crock of cream. One sees how hopeless it is, gives up, and drowns. The other is too stupid to know he's licked. He keeps on paddling. In a few hours he has churned so much butter that it forms an island on which he floats, cool and comfortable, until the milkmaid comes and chucks him out. That water spilled in and ran out. Suppose it didn't run out. I explored the bottom of the catch basin. The drain was large by our standards, but I thought I could plug it. Could I stay afloat while the room filled up, filled the hole above, and pushed me out the spout? Well, I could find out. I had a can. The can looked like a pint, and a pint's a pound the world round, and a cubic foot of water weighs, on Earth, a little over 60 pounds. But I had to be sure. My feet are 11 inches long. They've been that size since I was 10. I took a lot of ribbing until I grew up to them. I marked 11 inches on the floor with 2 pennies. It turns out that a dollar bill is 2.5 inches wide and a quarter is a smidgen under an inch. Shortly, I knew the dimensions of room and can pretty accurately. I held the can under the stream, letting it fill and dumping it fast while I ticked off cans of water on my left hand and counted seconds. Eventually, I calculated how long it would take to fill the room. I didn't like the answer, so I did it over. It would take 14 hours to fill the room and the hole above, plus an hour to allow for crude methods. Could I stay afloat that long? You're darn tootin' I could, if I had to, and I had to. There isn't any limit to how long a man can float if he doesn't panic. I balled my slacks and stuffed them in the drain. I almost lost them, so I wrapped them around the can and used the bundle as a cork. It stayed put, and I used the rest of my clothes to caulk it. Then I waited, feeling cocky. Maybe the flood would create the diversion I needed for the rest of the caper. Slowly the basin filled. The water got about an inch below floor level and stopped. A pressure switch, I suppose. I should have known that creatures who could build 8G constant boost ships would design plumbing to fail safe. I wish we could. I recovered my clothes, all but one sock, and spread them to dry. I hoped the sock would foul a pump or something, but I doubted it. They were good engineers. I never really believed that story about the frogs. Another can was tossed down, roast beef and soggy potatoes. It was filling, but I began to long for peaches. The can was stenciled, available for subsidized resale on Luna, which made it possible that Skinny and Fatty had come by this food honestly. I wondered how they liked sharing their supplies. No doubt they did so only because Wormface had twisted their arms, which made me wonder why Wormface wanted me alive. I was in favor of it, but couldn't see why he was. I decided to call each can a day and let the empties be my calendar, which reminded me that I had not worked out how long it would take to get home on a 1G boost if it turned out that I could not arrange automatic piloting at 8Gs. I was stymied on getting out of the cell. I hadn't even nibbled at what I would do if I did get out. Correction, when I got out. But I could work ballistics. I didn't need books. I've met people, even in this day and age, who can't tell a star from a planet and who think of astronomical distances simply as big. They remind me of those primitives who have just four numbers, 1, 2, 3, and many. But any tenderfoot scout knows the basic facts, and a fellow bitten by the space bug, such as myself, usually knows a number of figures. Mother very thoughtfully made a jelly sandwich under no protest. Could you forget that after saying it a few times? Okay, lay it out so. Mother, Mercury, 39 cents. Very, Venus, 72 cents. Thoughtfully, Terra, $1. Made, Mars, $1.50. A, asteroids, assorted prices, unimportant. Jelly, Jupiter, $5.20. Sandwich, Saturn, $9.50. Under, Uranus, $19. No, Neptune, $30. Protest, Pluto, $39.50. The prices are distances from the Sun in astronomical units. An AU is the mean distance of Earth from Sun, 93 million miles. It is easier to remember one figure that everybody knows, and some little figures, than it is to remember figures in millions and billions. I use dollar signs because a figure has more flavor if I think of it as money, which Dad considers deplorable. Some way, you must remember them, or you don't know your own neighborhood. Now we come to a joker. The list says that Pluto's distance is 39.5 times Earth's distance, but Pluto and Mercury have very eccentric orbits, and Pluto's is a dilly. Its distance varies almost 2 billion miles, more than the distance from the Sun to Uranus. Pluto creeps to the orbit of Neptune and a hair inside, then swings way out and stays there a couple of centuries. It makes only 4 round trips in 1,000 years. But I had seen that article about how Pluto was coming into its summer, so I knew it was close to the orbit of Neptune now, and would be for the rest of my life, my life expectancy in Centerville. I didn't look like a preferred risk here. That gave an easy figure, 30 astronomical units. Acceleration problems are simple. S equals 1/2 AT squared. Distance equals half the acceleration times the square of elapsed time. If astrogation were that simple, any sophomore could pilot a rocket ship. The complications come from gravitational fields and the fact that everything moves 14 directions at once. But I could disregard gravitational fields and planetary motions. At the speeds a Wormface ship makes, neither factor matters until you are very close. I wanted a rough answer. I missed my slipstick. Dad says that anyone who can't use a slide rule is a cultural illiterate and should not be allowed to vote. Mine is a beauty, a K&E 20-inch log-log duplex desitrig. Dad surprised me with it after I mastered a 10-inch polyphase. We ate potato soup that week, but Dad says you should always budget luxuries first. I knew where it was, home on my desk. No matter, I had figures, formula, pencil, and paper. First, a check problem. Fats had said Pluto, 5 days, and 8 gravities. It's a two-piece problem. Accelerate for half time and half distance, do a skew flip, and decelerate the other half time and distance. You can't use the whole distance in the equation, as time appears as a square. It's a parabolic. Was Pluto in opposition, or quadrature, or conjunction? Nobody looks at Pluto, so why remember where it is on the ecliptic? Oh well, the average distance was 30 AUs. That would give a close enough answer. Half that distance, in feet, is 1 half times 30 times 93 million times 5,280. 8 gravities is 8 times 32.2 feet per second per second. Speed increases by 258 feet per second every second up to skew flip, and decreases just as fast thereafter. So, 1 half times 30 times 93 million times 5,280 equals 1 half times 8 times 32.2 times t squared. And you wind up with the time for half the trip in seconds. Double that for full trip. Divide by 3,600 to get hours, divide by 24, and you have days. On a slide rule, such a problem takes 40 seconds, most of it to get your decimal point correct. It's as easy as computing sales tax. It took me at least an hour, and almost as long to prove it, using a different sequence, and a third time, because the answers didn't match. I had forgotten to multiply by 5,280, and had miles on one side, and feet on the other. A no good way to do arithmetic. Then a fourth time, because my confidence was shaken. I tell you, the slide rule is the greatest invention since girls. But I got a proved answer. 5.5 days. I was on Pluto. Or maybe Neptune. No, on Neptune I would not be able to jump to a 12-foot ceiling. Pluto alone matched all facts. So I erased and computed the trip at 1 gravity, with turnover. 15 days. It seemed to me that it ought to take at least 8 times as long at 1G as at 8, more likely 64. Then I was glad I had bulled my way through analytical geometry, for I made a rough plot and saw the trouble. Squared time cut down the advantage, because the more boost, the shorter the trip, and the shorter the trip, the less time in which to use the built-up speed. To cut time in half, you need 4 times as much boost. To cut it to a quarter, you need 16 times the boost, and so on. This way lies bankruptcy. To learn that I could get home in about 2 weeks at 1 gravity cheered me. I couldn't starve in 2 weeks. If I could steal a ship, if I could run it, if I could climb out of this hole, if... not if, but when. I was too late for college this year. 15 more days wouldn't matter. I had noticed, in the first problem, the speed we had been making at skew flip. More than 11,000 miles per second. That's a nice speed, even in space. It made me think. Consider the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, 4 3/10 light years away. The distance you hear so often on quiz shows. How long at 8 G's? The problem was the same sort, but I had to be careful about decimal points. The figures mount up. A light year is... I had forgotten. So multiply 186,000 miles per second, the speed of light, by the seconds in a year, 365.25, times 24, times 3,600, and get 5,880,000,000,000 miles. Multiply that by 4.3 and get 25,284,000,000,000 miles. Call it 25 trillion miles. Phew! It works out to a year and 5 months, not as long as a trip around the horn only last century. Why, these monsters had star travel! I don't know why I was surprised. It had been staring me in the face. I had assumed that Wormface had taken me to his home planet, that he was a Plutonian, or plutocrat, or whatever the word is. But he couldn't be. He breathed air. He kept his ship warm enough for me. When he wasn't in a hurry, he cruised at 1G, near enough. He used lighting that suited my eyes. Therefore, he came from the sort of planet I came from. Proxima Centauri is a double star, as you know if you do crossword puzzles, and one is a twin for our own sun. Size, temperature, special pattern. Is it a fair guess that it has a planet like Earth? I had a dirty hunch that I knew Wormface's home address. I knew where he didn't come from. Not from a planet that runs a couple of centuries in utter airlessness, with temperatures pushing absolute zero, followed by a summer in which some gases melt, but water is solid rock, and even Wormface has to wear a spacesuit, nor from anywhere in our system, for I was sure as taxes that Wormface felt at home only on a planet like ours. Never mind the way he looked. Spiders don't look like us, but they like the things we like. There must be 1,000 spiders in our houses for every one of us. Wormface and his kin would like Earth. My fear was that they liked it too much. I looked at that Proxima Centauri problem and saw something else. The turnover speed read 1,110,000 miles per second, 6 times the speed of light. Relativity theory says that's impossible. I wanted to talk to Dad about it. Dad reads everything from The Anatomy of Melancholy to Acta Mathematica and Paris Match, and will sit on a curbstone separating damp newspapers wrapped around garbage in order to see continued on page 8. Dad would haul down a book and we'd look it up. Then he would try 4 or 5 more with other opinions. Dad doesn't hold with the idea that it must be true or they wouldn't have printed it. He doesn't consider any opinion sacred. It shocked me the first time he took out a pen and changed something in one of my math books. Still, even if speed of light was a limit, 4 or 5 years wasn't impossible, or even impractical. We've been told for so long that star trips, even to the nearest stars, would take generations, that we may have a wrong slant. A mile of lunar mountains is a long way, but 1 trillion miles in empty space may not be. But what was Wormface doing on Pluto? If you were invading another solar system, how would you start? I'm not joking. A dungeon on Pluto is no joke, and I never laughed at Wormface. Would you just barge in, or toss your hat in first? They seemed far ahead of us in engineering, but they couldn't have known that ahead of time. Wouldn't it be smart to build a supply base in that system in some spot nobody ever visited? Then you could set up advance bases. Say, on an airless satellite of a likely-looking planet, from which you could scout the surface of the target planet. If you lost your scouting base, you would pull back to main base and work out a new attack. Remember that while Pluto is a long way off to us, it was only 5 days from Luna for Wormface. Think about World War II, back when speeds were slow. Main base is safely out of reach, USA, Pluto. But only about 5 days from Advance Base, England, the Moon, which is 3 hours from Theater of Operations, France, Germany, Earth. That's a slow way to operate, but it worked for the Allies in World War II. I just hoped it would not work for Wormface's gang, though I didn't see anything to prevent it. Somebody chucked down another can, spaghetti and meatballs. If it had been canned peaches, I might not have had the fortitude to do what I did next, which was to use it for a hammer before I opened it. I beat an empty can into a flat, narrow shape, and beat a point on it, which I sharpened on the edge of the catch basin. When I was through, I had a dagger, not a good one, but it made me feel less helpless. Then I ate. I felt sleepy and went to sleep in a warm glow. I was still a prisoner, but I had a weapon of sorts, and I believed that I had figured out what I was up against. Getting a problem analyzed is 2/3 of solving it. I didn't have nightmares. The next thing tossed down the hole was Fats. Skinny landed on him seconds later. I backed off and held my dagger ready. Skinny ignored me, picked himself up, looked around, went to the water spout and got a drink. Fats was in no shape to do anything. His breath was knocked out. I looked at him and thought what a nasty parcel he was. Then I thought, oh, what the deuce. He had massaged me when I needed it. I heaved him onto his stomach and began artificial respiration. In 4 or 5 pushes, his motor caught, and he was able to breathe. He gasped,
"That's enough!"
I backed off, got my knife out. Skinny was sitting against a wall, ignoring us. Fats looked at my feeble weapon and said,
"Put that away, kid. We're bosom buddies now."
"We are?"
"Yeah. Us human types had better stick together."
He sighed wretchedly.
"After all we've done for him, that's gratitude."
"What do you mean?"
"Huh? Just what I said. He decided he could do without us, so Annie doesn't live here anymore."
"Shut up,"
the skinny one said flatly. Fats screwed his face into a pout.
"You shut up. I'm tired of that. It's shut up here, shut up there, all day long, and look where we are."
"Shut up," I said.
Fats shut up. I never did find out what had happened, because Fats seldom gave the same explanation twice. The older man never spoke, except for that tiresome order to shut up, or in monosyllables, even less helpful. But one thing was clear. They had lost their jobs as assistant gangsters, or fifth columnists, or whatever you call a human being who would stooge against his own race. Once Fats said,
"Matter of fact, it's your fault."
"Mine?" I dropped my hand to my tin can knife.
"Yours. If you hadn't butted in, he wouldn't have got sore."
"I didn't do anything."
"Says you. You swiped his 2 best prizes, that's all, and held him up when he planned to hightail it back here."
"Oh, but that wasn't your fault."
"So I told him. You try telling him. Take your hand away from that silly nail file."
Fats shrugged.
"Like I always say, let bygones be bygones."
I finally learned the thing I wanted most to know. About the 5th time I brought up the matter of Pee-wee, Fats said,
"What do you want to know about the brat for?"
"I just want to know whether she's alive or dead."
"Oh, she's alive. Leastwise, she was last time I seen her."
"When was that?"
"You asked too many questions. Right here."
"She's here?"
"That's what I said, wasn't it? Around everywhere and always underfoot. Living like a princess, if you ask me."
Fats picked his teeth and frowned.
"Why, he should make a pet out of her and treat us the way he did beats me. It ain't right."
I didn't think so either, but for another reason. The idea that gallant little Pee-wee was the spoiled darling of Wormface, I found impossible to believe. There was some explanation, or Fats was lying. "You mean he doesn't have her locked up?"
"What's it get him? Where's she gonna go?"
I pondered that myself. Where could you go, when to step outdoors was suicide, even if Pee-wee had her spacesuit, and that, at least, was probably locked up? Even if a ship was at hand and empty when she got outside, even if she could get into it, she still wouldn't have a ship's brain, the little gadget that served as a lock. What happened to the mother thing?
"The what?"
"The," I hesitated, "the non-human who was in my spacesuit with me. You must know you were there. Is she alive? Is she here?" But Fats was brooding.
"Them bugs don't interest me none,"
he said sourly, and I could get no more out of him. But Pee-wee was alive, and a hard lump in me was suddenly gone. She was here. Her chances, even as a prisoner, had been enormously better on the moon. Nevertheless, I felt almost ecstatic to know that she was near. I began thinking about ways to get a message to her. As for Fats's insinuation that she was playing footsie with Wormface, it bothered me not at all. Pee-wee was unpredictable, and sometimes a brat, and often exasperating, as well as conceited, supercilious, and downright childish. But she would be burned alive rather than turn traitor. Joan of Arc had not been made of sterner stuff. We 3 kept uneasy truce. I avoided them, slept with one eye open, and tried not to sleep unless they were asleep first, and I always kept my dagger at hand. I did not bathe after they joined me. It would have put me at a disadvantage. The older one ignored me. Fats was almost friendly. He pretended not to be afraid of my puny weapon, but I think he was. The reason I think so comes from the first time we were fed. 3 cans dropped from the ceiling. Skinny picked up one, Fats got one, but when I circled around to take the third, Fats snatched it. I said, "Give me that, please." Fats grinned.
"What makes you think this is for you, sonny boy?"
3 cans, 3 people.
"So what? I'm feeling a mite hungry. I don't hardly think I can spare it."
"I'm hungry too. Be reasonable." He seemed to consider it.
"Tell you what, I'll sell it to you."
I hesitated. It had a shifty logic. Wormface couldn't walk into Lunar Base Commissary and buy these rations. Probably Fats or his partner had bought them. I wouldn't mind signing IOUs. $100 a meal, $1,000, or $1,000,000. Money no longer meant anything. Why not humor him? No. If I gave in, if I admitted I had to dicker with him for my prison rations, he would own me. I'd wait on him hand and foot, do anything he told me, just to eat. I let him see my tin dagger. "I'll fight you for it." Fats glanced at my hand and grinned broadly.
"Can't you take a joke?"
He tossed me the can. There was no trouble at feeding times after that. We lived like that happy family you sometimes see in traveling zoos, a lion caged with a lamb. It is a startling exhibit, but the lamb has to be replaced frequently. Fats liked to talk, and I learned things from him when I could sort out truth from lies. His name, so he said, was Jacques Debar de Vigny.
"Call me Jacques."
And the older man was Timothy Johnson. But I had a hunch that their real names could be learned only by inspecting post office bulletin boards. Despite Jacques' pretense of knowing everything, I soon decided that he knew nothing about Wormface's origin and little about his plans and purposes. Wormface did not seem the sort to discuss things with lower animals. He would simply make use of them, as we use horses. Jacques admitted one thing readily.
"Yeah, we put the snatch on the brat. There's no uranium on the moon. Those stories are just to get suckers. We were wasting our time. And a man's got to eat, don't he?"
I didn't make the obvious retort. I wanted information. Tim said,
"Shut up." What of it, Tim? You worried about the FBI? You think the man can put the arm on you here?"
"Shut up," I said.
"Happens I feel like talking, so blow it." It was easy. The brat's got more curiosity than 7 cats. He knew she was coming and when.
Jock looked thoughtful.
"He always knows. He's got lots of people working for him, some high up. All I had to do was be in Luna City and get acquainted. I made the contact because Tim here ain't the fatherly type, the way I am. I get to talking with her, I buy her a Coke, I tell her about the romance of hunting uranium on the moon and similar hogwash. Then I sigh and say, 'It's too bad I can't show her the mind of my partner and I.' That's all it took. When the tourist party visited Tombaugh Station, she got away and sneaked out the lock. She worked that part out her own self. She's sly, that one. All we had to do was wait where I told her. Didn't even have to be rough with her, until she got worried about taking longer for the crawler to get to our mine than I told her."
Jock grinned.
"She fights pretty well for her weight. Scratch me some."
Poor little Pee-wee. Too bad she hadn't drawn and quartered him. But the story sounded true, for it was the way Pee-wee would behave. Sure of herself, afraid of no one, unable to resist any educational experience. Jock went on.
"It wasn't the brat he wanted. He wanted her old man. Had some swindle to get him to the moon. Didn't work."
Jock grinned sourly.
"That was a bad time. Things ain't good when he don't have his own way. But he had to settle for the brat. Tim here pointed out to him he could trade."
Tim chucked in one word, which I took as a general denial. Jock raised his eyebrows.
"Listen to Vinegar Puss. Nice manners, ain't he?"
Maybe I should have kept quiet since I was digging for facts, not philosophy. But I've got Pee-wee's failing myself. When I don't understand, I have an unbearable itch to know why. I didn't, and don't, understand what made Jock tick. Jock, why did you do it?
Huh?
Look, you're a human being. At least he looked like one. As you pointed out, we humans had better stick together. How could you bring yourself to kidnap a little girl and turn her over to him?
Are you crazy, boy?
I don't think so.
You talk crazy. Have you ever tried not doing something he wanted? Try it sometime.
I saw his point. Refusing Wormface would be like a rabbit spitting in a snake's eye, as I knew too well. Jock went on.
You got to understand the other man's viewpoint. Live and let live, I always say. We got grabbed while we were messing around looking for Carnotite, and after that, we never stood no chance. You can't fight City Hall. That gets you nowhere. So we made a dicker. We run his errands. He pays us in uranium.
My faint sympathy vanished. I wanted to throw up. And you got paid?
Well, you might say we got time on the books.
I looked around our cell. You made a bad deal, Jock grimaced, looking like a sulky baby.
Maybe so. But be reasonable, kid. You gotta cooperate with the inevitable. These boys are moving in. They got what it takes. You seen that yourself. Well, a man's gotta look out for number one, don't he? It's a cinch. Nobody else will. Now, I seen a case like this when I was no older than you, and it taught me a lesson. Our town had run quietly for years, but the big fellow was getting old and losing his grip. Whereupon some boys from St. Louis moved in. Things were confused for a while. A man had to know which way to jump, else he woke up wearing a wooden overcoat, like as not. Those that seen the handwriting made out. Those that didn't, well, it don't do no good to buck the current, I always say. That makes sense, don't it?
I could follow his logic, provided you accepted his live-louse standard, but he had left out a key point. Even so, Jock, I don't see how you could do that to a little girl.
Huh? I just explained how we couldn't help it.
But you could. Even allowing how hard it is to face up to him and refuse orders, you had a perfect chance to duck out.
What do you mean?
He sent you to Luna City to find her. You said so. You've got a return fair benefit. I know you have. I know the rules. All you had to do was sit tight where he couldn't reach you and take the next ship back to Earth. You didn't have to do his dirty work.
But...
I cut him off. Maybe you couldn't help yourself out in a lunar desert. Maybe you wouldn't feel safe even inside Tombaugh Station. But when he sent you into Luna City, you had your chance. You didn't have to steal a little girl and turn her over to a bug-eyed monster. He looked baffled, then answered quickly.
Kip, I like you. You're a good boy, but you ain't smart. You don't understand.
I think I do.
No, you don't.
He leaned toward me, started to put a hand on my knee. I drew back. He went on.
There's something I didn't tell you, for fear you'd think I was a zombie or something. They operated on us.
Huh?
They operated on us. They planted bombs in our heads. Remote control. Like a missile. A man gets out of line. He punches a button. Bluey. Brains all over the ceiling.
He fumbled at the nape of his neck.
See the scar? My hair is getting kind of long, but if you look close, I'm sure you'll see it. It can't have disappeared entirely. See it?
I started to look. I might even have been sold on it. I had been forced to believe less probable things lately. Tim cut short my suspended judgment with one explosive word. Jock flinched, then braced himself and said,
"Don't pay any attention to him."
I shrugged and moved away. Jock didn't talk the rest of that day. That suited me. The next morning, I was roused by Jock's hand on my shoulder.
Wake up, Kip! Wake up!
I groped for my toy weapon.
It's over there by the wall, but it ain't ever gonna do you any good now.
I grabbed it. What do you mean? Where's Tim?
You didn't wake up?
Huh?
This is what I've been scared of. Cripes, boy! I just had to talk to somebody. You slept through it?
Through what? And where's Tim? Jock was shivering and sweating.
They blue-lighted us, that's what. They took Tim.
He shuddered.
I'm glad it was him. I thought, well, maybe you've noticed. I'm a little stout. They like fat.
What do you mean? What have they done with him?
Poor old Tim. He had his faults, like anybody. But he's soup by now. That's what.
He shuddered again.
They like soup. Bones and all.
I don't believe it. You're trying to scare me.
So?
He looked me up and down.
They'll probably take you next. Son, if you're smart, you'll take that letter opener of yours over to that horse trough and open your veins. It's better that way.
I said, why don't you? Here, I'll lend it to you. He shook his head and shivered.
I ain't smart.
I don't know what became of Tim. I don't know whether the worm faces ate people or not. You can't say cannibal. We may be mutton to them. I wasn't especially scared, because I had long since blown all fuses in my scare circuits. What happens to my body after I'm through with it doesn't matter to me, but it did to Jock. He had a phobia about it. I don't think Jock was a coward. Cowards don't even try to become prospectors on the moon. He believed his theory, and it shook him. He halfway admitted that he had more reason to believe it than I had known. He had been to Pluto once before, so he said, and other men who had come along or been dragged on that trip hadn't come back. When feeding time came, two cans, he said he wasn't hungry and offered me his rations. That night, he sat up and kept himself awake. Finally, I just had to go to sleep before he did. I awoke from one of those dreams where you can't move. The dream was correct. Sometime not long before, I had surely been blue-lighted. Jock was gone. I never saw either of them again. Somehow I missed them. Jock, at least. It was a relief not to have to watch all the time. It was luxurious to bathe. But it gets mighty boring, pacing your cage alone. I have no illusions about them. There must be well over 3 billion people I would rather be locked up with. But they were people. Tim didn't have anything else to recommend him. He was as coldly vicious as a guillotine. But Jock had some slight awareness of right and wrong, or he wouldn't have tried to justify himself. You might say he was just weak. But I don't hold with the idea that to understand all is to forgive all. You follow that, and first thing you know, you're sentimental over murderers and rapists and kidnappers and forgetting their victims. That's wrong. I'll weep over the likes of Pee-wee, not over criminals whose victims they are. I missed Jock's talk, but if there were some way to drown such creatures at birth, I'd take my turn as executioner. That goes double for Tim. If they ended up as soup for hobgoblins, I couldn't honestly be sorry, even though it might be my turn tomorrow. As soup, they probably had their finest hour.